from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. On Monday, federal judge James Ware will conduct a hearing over whether now retired Judge Vaughn Walker should have stepped aside during last year's Proposition 8 gay marriage case. In that case, Judge Walker ruled that Proposition 8 violated the California state constitution because it, quote, prevents California from fulfilling its constitutional obligation to provide marriages on an equal basis. Now, gay marriage opponents are arguing that Judge Walker's ruling should be set aside, that he never should have presided over the case because he is gay, and by way of his own ruling would now be able to marry his longtime partner if he should so choose. The question of when judges should step aside has gained attention in many courtrooms, not just this one, including the United States Supreme Court. And so this morning we want to take up the case of judicial disclosure and whether or not judges or when whether judges should recuse themselves. Joining us to do that, Deborah Rohde. She's professor of law and director of the Center on the Legal Profession at the Stanford University Law School. Professor Rohde, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Happy to have you join us. And joining us as well, John Eastman, law professor and former dean at the Chapman University School of Law in Orange, California, also the founding director of the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence. John Eastman, good morning.
Dave, thanks for having me back on your program.
Happy to have you both here. Let's begin by trying to make a distinction, if we might, between disclosure and recusal, because there's a difference of opinion about both of these matters. Deborah Rohde, on the question of disclosure, a lot of people seem to feel whether or not they think that Judge Walker should have recused himself, there seems to be sort of more unanimity of opinion that he at least should have disclosed what his personal situation was. Do you agree with that?
I do. I think that this effort is a distraction from a really important constitutional question, and his silence at an earlier point has now given rise to litigation that can only muddy the waters. I think he had an opportunity to put the matter at rest by, you know, letting parties know that if they wanted to make a motion based on his sexual orientation or his status in a relationship, now was the time to do so at the outset of the proceedings and put the issue to rest. I think it's quite clear under existing precedents that a motion to recuse would have been denied, and there's ample case law suggesting that simply one's identity should not be the basis for requiring a judge to step down. The Code of Judicial Ethics requires that a judge should recuse himself whenever he has an interest that could be substantially affected by the outcome of the proceedings or in any circumstance where his impartiality might reasonably be questioned. And I think if he had said at the outset he was in a committed relationship, he had no intention of marrying under California law, it would have put out of doubt in the minds of the public that he had any direct personal stake in the proceedings.
Well, let's pursue then the next part of that. If there is sort of general agreement, and from most of what I've read, there does seem to be that sense that it would have been cleaner if Judge Walker had come forward and disclosed, not set aside or not stepped aside, but disclosed. Let's get to that second part of whether or not he should have stepped aside. And John Eastman, you've argued that he should have because of this question that he could benefit or that he would have an interest in the outcome of his ruling. Sketch out for us your point of view, because opponents of gay marriage are also quick to say, Charles Cooper, the lawyer in this case, they're not saying this because he was gay. They're saying this because he could have benefited.
Well, that's right. And I think it's important to keep that distinction in mind, however fine a one it might be. There were rumors that Judge Walker was gay well at the outset of the case. And, of course, lawyers are not supposed to file motions for disqualification based on rumors. And that's where the disclosure issue becomes important. Disclosing that he was in a long-term, 10-year committed relationship, the very type of relationship that one would expect could well give rise to an interest in marriage, which is what, of course, he's ruling on in this case, not just for the particular plaintiffs in this case, but it was a statewide injunction that he issued that would, from which he himself personally will benefit if he and his long-term partner have an interest in this. It's that relationship that should have been disclosed. There are two standards under the Judicial Ethics Code. One is if you have an interest, financial or otherwise, from which you will personally benefit, you are obligated to recuse yourself. And then the second is if you're if the circumstances are such that a reasonable person might think your interest would affect the outcome of the proceeding or could substantially affect the outcome of the proceeding, then you are required to disclose the information of those circumstances so that the lawyers can decide whether to waive that concern and proceed with the case or ask for a different judge. Neither of those things happened here. And I think the long-term committed relationship actually is one that would have required recusal from this. We don't want somebody, and it's very clear, for example, if this was a case filed by Judge Walker's partner seeking marriage, and he could not rule on that case, he would be directly a beneficiary of the ruling. This is only one step removed from that because of that relationship. And again, none of that is tied to the fact that he's gay. That's the status thing that the prior case law has said is impermissible grounds for recusal. This is because of the circumstances of that relationship. He is a likely direct beneficiary of his own ruling.
And Deborah Rohde, come back on that point. Why is this not something that, in your judgment, required recusal?
Well, I think if he had said what I earlier suggested, that he did not have an intention to marry under California law, then there would be no direct stake. And then the sole issue would be his status. And that's what earlier cases have made quite clear is inappropriate as a basis for recusal. One of the early cases involving gender discrimination, Constance Baker Motley was a former NAACP attorney, and the defendants sought to remove her on the grounds that she identified with those who had suffered discrimination in employment because of sex or race. And she pointed out if that were the basis for recusal, then no court could hear the case because all attorneys had a sex. And similarly, in civil rights cases, when defendants have sought to remove a judge because of express sympathy with a constituency that would benefit from the ruling, the courts have been quite clear that's not a basis for removal. It would be ludicrous to assume that only blacks have a stake in appropriate resolution of race relations cases. And so I think the courts have been justifiably wary about circumstances. And so that's why the standard is reasonably might be questioned.
It sounds like the question here really is one of specificity and how directly the benefit might be, John Eastman, because you wouldn't, I'm sure, want to argue that a black judge couldn't rule in an affirmative action case, right? So how direct does the benefit have to be?
His daughter is an applicant to the school involved in the litigation, and then he would have a direct financial or other stake in the case, and he could not rule that. And the fact that to this day, Judge Walker has not told us. We have no plans, no interest ever in getting married, and therefore I am not a direct beneficiary of this. If he had said that up front, it would have been a waivable potential conflict. The fact that he not only didn't say it up front, but has continued to refuse to address that issue is what gives rise to the prospect that he has a direct interest in this case, or at the very least, a reasonable observer would think he has a stake in the case and ought to have recused himself.
John Eastman, again, professor of law at Chapman University School of Law, joining us along with Deborah Rohde, professor of law and director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford Law School. We want to open it up to your calls as well. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. Should Judge Walker have disclosed, number one? Number two, should he have stepped aside? What's your feeling about the degree of specific benefit or interest a judge can or cannot have if he or she is going to preside over a trial? You can join us now at 866-733-6786. Email at forum@kqed.org or post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Deborah Rohde, how does this question inform the general question, I guess, of judicial recusal? Is it something that we need to pay more attention to?
Well, I think we do, especially at the Supreme Court level, because in One of the anomalies of the process that we've now constructed is that the judge whose impartiality is being questioned is the first one to pass judgment on the motion. And, you know, it's by definition, they are not disinterested parties, and one of the fundamental axioms of American jurisprudence is that no man should sit in judgment on his own cause. And yet, we tolerate it at the state and lower federal court level because there's an appeals process.
Which is what's going on now in Judge Walker's
case. Well, right,
case.
And Judge Walker's, you know, of course, no longer presiding over this case. But at the Supreme Court level, there's no such check. And it's Supreme Court isn't even subject to the Code of Judicial Ethics with those standards. And what has happened in recent months has been a number of cases in which concerns have been raised about Justices Scalia and Thomas attending fundraisers while matters that the foundations who cared about those cases were pending before the court, and in other circumstances where they've attended conferences sponsored by those foundations. And that's clearly inappropriate under the Judicial Code of Ethics. And the Supreme Court, regrettably, has no process for checking an individual judge's own justice's own decisions. And it came up earlier in 2004 after allegations that Justice Scalia had gone duck hunting with Vice President Cheney when a case involving Cheney's claim of executive privilege was pending before the court. So I think it's time to rethink that settled practice, and there is legislation pending in Congress that would create a process for review of recusal motions. Or the Supreme Court could do it on its own motion and could establish an outside panel to review the decisions. And I think, you know, in our iconic images, justice is blind, and for a reason. We want to trust those to do justice, to come to the process as free as from prejudice and preconceptions as possible. So we need an ethical oversight that provides some disinterested view.
Let's hear what, sorry to hop in, but we've got lots of callers stacking up, and I'd like to get them engaged in our conversation as well on this interesting question of when judges ought to step aside, when they ought to disclose, and when, as Deborah Rohde suggests, there ought to be some way of overseeing that process so that it's not just up to the judges themselves to make that decision. Let's hear from Larry first in San Anselmo. Larry, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a civil rights lawyer, and I have had numerous cases throughout the state where judges have shown an inherent bias in their decision making, where they have commented about, you know, their view of the merits. That didn't happen in this case. But I got to tell you, from my experience in the other situations, there does need to be some kind of outside review. And it should not be judges, because when you try and get them reviewed in the California judicial process, it's judges reviewing judges, and frankly, they just cover up for them.
Yeah.
So it's a real problem, and some kind of outside review should do it so that they could show that in any particular instance there is a violation or there isn't.
Larry, thanks. Thanks for the call. John Eastman, your view on whether or not we need some sort of extra review of this kind of decision making?
Well, I think a lot of the claims of bias, particularly those level at the Supreme Court, are exaggerated. And I want to talk a little bit about the process there, because it's not quite as a single judge just deciding for himself as we might believe. The judges work very closely with the clerk's office to screen the cases to make sure they're recusing themselves from any case in which they have a financial stake. And what's going on now are broader claims that if they've expressed an interest on the case, or if their spouse or organizations that they've given a speech to have expressed a view on a case or on constitutional interpretation generally, that ought to be enough to recuse them. And that broad a brush is being leveled with a very partisan overtone, because the conduct that Justice Scalia and Thomas, for example, are accused of is one, the facts are not correct, but two, even if they were correct, that they had attended a fundraiser that was also attended by some other people that were supporting an organization who was seeking a free speech ruling in the Citizens United case. That's the thing. Justice Stevens is being honored at a big fundraising dinner by Equal Justice, which is a frequent amicus before the court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been a frequent honoree at fundraisers for ACLU organizations around the country that are among the most frequent litigators before the court.
I want to let Deborah Rohde come back on those points because it's an interesting one. But before I do, John Eastman, just briefly, if you would, though, on the question of whether or not there should be some sort of, as Larry was trying to get at, some sort of extra review, because if you feel that Judge Walker should have stepped aside, should there be some sort of general review of that individual choice?
Well, yes, I think there should be in an ideal world, but it's a very complicated question because if the review, let's talk about the Supreme Court, for example. If you're going to give the review to the United States Congress, there's a real threat of politics intruding on, and we see that now. We saw it, you know, back with Franklin Roosevelt, attempts to pack the court. We see it most recently with attempts to have new judges appointed or sitting judges designated when there's a recusal to kind of skew the outcome of predicted outcome of cases. So politics intruding on that more than it has already is a very dangerous thing and has separation of powers implications. So how you would structure that review is a huge problem.
And Deborah Rohde, just briefly, please, on John Eastman's point that justices on both sides of the political spectrum have spoken to various groups and that in and of itself shouldn't be thought of as something that would require recusal.
Well, speaking before groups is fine. It's if you're assisting them in fundraising, and there the Code of Judicial Conduct is pretty clear. And so I would distinguish some of those cases. But, you know, I think the central problem to keep in mind is not whether the conduct of the individual justices in those particular cases violated judicial ethics or compromised the court's credibility. It's whether they alone should have been the ones to decide it. And that's I think we do need a review process. I agree with John that you don't want to give it to Congress or any political entity, and I think we just have to live with some imperfections in the system. But I do think that it's possible, and there have been a number of proposals that have been put forward by Alliance for Justice and one of the congressional bills now that would create panels that would be composed of justices who weren't on the same court.
And let's get back to some of our calls, if we might. Let's go to Colin next in San Francisco. Colin, go ahead.
Good morning. I've heard all the arguments as to why Judge Walker should have recused himself, and I'm not impressed. Didn't the pro-Prop 8 side make a tactical decision, knowing full well the rumors about his sexuality, that the judge was an appointee of Ronald Reagan and George Bush the first, and decided that he would be the most favorable judge to hear their case. And then they simply lost the case. It seems to me that Mr. Eastman's argument is that it would be perfectly fine for Judge Walker to have heard the case if he were simply a closeted gay, but somehow a partnered gay would not be acceptable to hear the case. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, Colin. You know, it's nice to set up straw man arguments and then knock them down. That's not the argument. And look, it's inappropriate for a lawyer to file a motion for recusal based on mere speculation. It wasn't until Judge Walker himself publicly announced that he was in a long-term committed relationship a year after the trial in this case that there was actual evidence of the circumstances that led to the recusal motion, and it was at that point that they very quickly brought the recusal motion. The notion that they somehow sat on this and then after the fact decided, oh, we didn't like that ruling, let's try and unravel it now, it's just patently false.
Some of our emails coming in. David writes, this issue is bogus. We don't expect black judges to recuse themselves on issues affecting blacks. We don't expect women judges to recuse themselves on issues affecting women. Why should we ask gay judges to recuse themselves on issues affecting gays? Though, again, everyone, we should, I think, note, David, that a number of people, even those who are opposed to gay marriage, are saying that it's not the question of Judge Walker's sexual preference. It's a question of whether or not he should have some sort of specific benefit from this. In other words, that his ruling would allow him to marry his long-term partner. Here's what Leslie writes, and this gets at more the specific question. She writes in, if Judge Walker holds a credit card, need he disclose that fact if it's a case regarding excessive credit card penalties? If Judge Walker owns a house, need he disclose that fact if a case regarding questionable mortgages comes up? No, just because he may have a benefit doesn't mean that he should be excluded. So again, help us drill down on this question of what's a benefit and what isn't, because it's tricky, I think, to tease out. Deborah Rohde, help us sort of sort through what constitutes a specific benefit.
Well, most of the cases have involved ones in which a party has a direct personal financial stake in the outcome of the case. So, recent Supreme Court decision involved Massey Coal Company, and its president was responsible for $3 million to the election campaign of one of the West Virginia justices. And that justice refused to recuse himself in an appeal involving a $50 million judgment against the company. And writing for the Supreme Court, Justice Kennedy, you know, found a fundamental failure of due process because in that case, it was quite obvious that that there had been a financial quid pro quo, or at least enough of a suggestion of one to raise concerns about impropriety. So I think those are the kinds of, mm-hmm. of cases. And, you know, most justices and judges who have dealings, for example, with the financial markets will set up blind trusts so that they don't know whether they have an investment in a particular company that might benefit before them. I clerked on the Second Circuit, where a lot of the New York judges followed that practice. And then for Thurgood Marshall, who, you know, put all of his assets, limited as they were in a, so that he would not be recused, you know, subject to recusal in kind of standard cases that were likely to come before the courts.
Let me ask you this, John Eastman. If Judge Walker had said, look, I'm gay and I'm involved in a long-term relationship, but I have no intention of marrying my partner, would you have been fine with him presiding over the case?
Well, it certainly takes it out of the mandatory recusal provisions of the code and then puts it into the more discretionary one, where based on that disclosure, the attorneys can then decide whether to waive any potential conflicts. And there they would be more affinity just institutional potential biases. And the question there is whether a reasonable observer, knowing those circumstances, would think he's too close to the issue to be able to rule in an even-handed and fair manner. And if the lawyers in that case, looking at that information, after that mandatory disclosure had been made, had agreed to waive the case, to waive the potential conflict, then he could certainly sit on the case. But because that disclosure did not occur, and to this day we don't even know whether he has disclaimed such an interest in being a direct beneficiary of his ruling, we haven't gotten to that point
but
yet.
That's why
that disclosure requirement is there up front.
Right. But we have to be, it seems to me at least, that we would want to be okay with that, because otherwise people are never going to be able to rule on anything. I mean, going back to the question of an African-American judge ruling on an affirmative action case, if he says, look, my daughter, as you were suggesting earlier in a hypothetical case, my daughter isn't going to benefit from this, no one's going to benefit from this, we have to be able to say that's okay. Otherwise, no one could rule on anything, right, John Eastman?
That's right. But it's why that disclosure is important up front. And I don't think any lawyer would not agree to a waiver under those circumstances, because, you know, if he doesn't agree to the waiver and they fight it, he's going to lose, number one, on the appeal of the recusal decision. But even if it gets assigned to another judge, as one of the callers earlier pointed out, the judges aren't going to take too kindly to that refusal to waiver. So, any refusal to waiver would have to be based on very solid information that would show this guy is biased to a reasonable observer. And what you've just described would not meet that standard.
And let's get back to our calls. Ray in Sunnyvale is next. Ray, just a brief question, if you would, please.
Sure. I understand Judge Scalia basically refused to recuse himself from a case which some people felt that he was a benefit from. Does that apply any guidance to the appeal process?
By appeal process, Ray, you're asking?
In terms of how to handle whether a judge should be recused.
All right. Well, let's talk about the specifics of this as briefly as we can, please, because we just have a couple of minutes left. But Deborah Rohde, this is the famous duck blind case, I think, where Antonin Scalia went duck hunting with Dick Cheney at the same time that the court, or roughly the same time that the court was going to hear a case regarding a case that involved Vice President Cheney making a claim of executive privilege in terms of certain energy policy discussions. I believe that was the case. Why or why not should Justice Scalia have recused himself? And then a brief response from John Eastman.
Well, he said he didn't share the same blind with the vice president, didn't discuss the case, and didn't think his impartiality could reasonably be questioned. But as the motion for recusal in that case indicated, 20 of the largest newspapers in the country thought otherwise. So I think that was a case where, you know, reasonable people could think just because you don't share the same blind, you shouldn't be going duck hunting with a party in a case before you. But I think the real point about that is less the merits of that particular case than the fact that there was no review of Justice Scalia's decision, and that's what we ought to be addressing.
And John Eastman, I know you believe that Justice Scalia did not need to recuse himself in that case, but do you concur that there should have been some sort of review process?
Well, I don't think outside the court. There was a review process inside the court, both with Justice Scalia discussing with the clerk, but also the other members of the court in either informal discussions, if it looks like it's a close call, and I don't think this one was, you know, and the court itself could take action to request the recusal. That kind of collegiality goes in a very informal way at the court. And we ought to be clear what we're talking about here. He had no financial or other direct interest in the case, and so this was only a question whether, because he was friends with the vice president, what a surprise, as a Supreme Court justice with no other high officials in government, that he was obligated to recuse himself. And I, you know, and that's in that much weaker. Would a reasonable observer think that he was so biased in the case? And I don't. This one's not even a close call in my view.
It's a tricky business, though. And just a last word on this, Deborah Rohde, isn't it, to discern these things that are more a question of judgment and personal leanings or personal orientations than a direct financial stake?
It is. And, you know, for the most part, I think we just have to trust the fairness of those we put on the bench and hope that they'll make good on their aspiration to, you know, provide equal justice under the law and set aside their personal beliefs. But I do think that it's always good to have those who aren't so directly implicated by the decision have an opportunity to pass judgment on it, and that's what we need at the Supreme Court level.
And we'll have to leave it there. Deborah Rohde, professor of law and director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford Law School. John Eastman, law professor and former dean at Chapman University School of Law. Again, the case comes up before Judge James Ware Monday morning. We'll be following that on KQED Public Radio as well. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.